Welcome to Shorties, a short true crime story.
Hi, happy Wednesday.
Happy Wednesday. These days are my favorites.
Why?
I don't know. I just like us both telling a story.
Oh,
it makes me happy.
Feels a little bit more balanced.
Yeah, no, it's like story sharing circle. You know, when you're when you're little,
going
around tell your favorite story.
What's it? Is that called? What is that called?
Is it story time?
Well, you would think that story time would be like just the teacher telling the story.
Share circle? There's something with circle in the.
It is something
circle.
I don't know. Anyways,
that's what giving me that energy
it
right
gives
now.
Me that energy too. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so. Story I'm doing today, it starts at around 9 p.m. on Wednesday, May 28th, 1980 in Anaheim, California.
Okay.
A 32-year-old single mom named Dorothy Scott is attending an after-hours work meeting with all of her coworkers. Dorothy worked as a receptionist for a company that sold gift shop items that are sort of geared towards hippies, like lots of like beaded necklaces and lava lamps and pipes and bongs and stuff like that.
Like lava lamps and bongs.
Yeah. During the meeting, one of her coworkers, a guy named Conrad Bostrin, started to feel sick. He had a large red mark in his arm, and after everyone kind of looked at it and discussed it, they decided it would probably be best for him to go to the hospital. So Dorothy offered to drive him, and another coworker named Pam Head joined them. On the way to the UC Irvine Medical Center emergency room, they stopped off at Dorothy's parents' house so that she could check on her 4-year-old son. Dorothy's parents always watched him while she worked, and since it was getting so late, she needed to communicate what was happening. Because remember, this is 1980, so there aren't any cell phones.
You can just text.
Yeah. During the quick stop, Dorothy switched her black scarf to a red scarf. After arriving at the ER, doctors informed Conrad that he had been bitten by a black widow spider.
Ooh, been there, done that.
Have you?
Oh, I've been bit multiple times by black widows.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they don't kill you. At least they didn't get me, but they don't kill you. They just give, it's like nasty side effects.
Oh, I'm so curious about that because I actually realized in this moment I intended to just out of curiosity research like what the symptoms are, what it looks like and all that stuff because I always thought that you did die.
No. It's like, I mean.
Wait, why do they call women black widows who kill all their husbands then?
I mean, I think it's just drama. Just sounds good. Ugh, you know, it's sexy.
Sensationalized.
And, yeah, exactly. You just get flu-like symptoms. And I think if you're near a doctor and you get the anti-venom, you're totally fine. Oh. But I went all day without getting it because I had gotten bitten. There was a nest underneath my desk in, I think it was like 8th grade.
Ooh.
So I kept repeatedly getting bitten by black widows.
At home or at school?
At school underneath the desk.
Whoa.
I was like back, you know, all the desks are just sitting there after summer.
Yeah.
And then things accumulate. And then I got bitten and...
Got bit.
My mom listens to this, so I want to get the grammar right.
I was bitten.
I like how you went kind of British right there. I was bitten.
I was bitten.
And just got flu-like symptoms.
I think.
And then you're
bit.
Fine.
Bit.
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 I got bit.
I was bit. I got.
That kind of. I got by some spiders.
You for sure got. That's no doubt there. Well, okay. Well, I didn't mean for that to be such a sidebar, but I was so curious. Anyways, all this time as I'm writing the story, I'm like, wow, what a miracle. She saved his life.
Eighth grade me got through it. So,
yeah. Okay. Anyways, so they informed it was a black widow spider bite and it was a really simple treatment and he could go home soon. Dorothy and Pam waited together in the waiting room, just, you know, watching the TV in the corner and flipping through magazines, just trying to pass the time. Pam said that Dorothy never left her side during this time. They were together the entire time. And he was really only there for like an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours at most. So they just stayed together in the same waiting room. Around 11 p.m., Conrad was discharged. And Dorothy offered to bring her car around to the front because he still looked like really unsteady. She used the bathroom really quick and then headed out to the parking lot while Pam waited with Conrad as he got a prescription filled. Only a couple of moments later, Pam and Conrad walk outside and they're surprised that Dorothy isn't there yet. They hadn't parked that far away and she should have been there waiting for them by then. And then they see her car speeding towards them. Just as it gets near, the high beams go on, blinding them. So they tried flagging her down like out of confusion, but the car zipped right by them. Pam said there was no way that Dorothy didn't see them because they were the only ones standing there and the high beams were literally shining right on them. So Pam even tried running after the car, but it sped up, screeching out of the parking lot and speeding away. So Pam and Conrad are like, what the actual shit was that? What?
Yeah.
You know? But then they're like, okay, hold on. Maybe she called to check on her son from the payphone outside when she was on the way to the car, and maybe there's some kind of emergency with him. And again, there are no cell phones, so they decide to sit down and wait for Dorothy to come back because, of course, she's going to come back for them, right?
Mm-hmm. You think.
They waited for 2 hours. 2 hours they spent just sitting there thinking, wow, she must have had a very serious emergency. But then finally, they call the police and they report her as missing. A few hours later, at 4:30 a.m., so this is technically 5.5 hours after Dorothy was last seen, her white Toyota station wagon was found set on fire 10 miles away from the hospital.
Oh my God.
There was nothing around and no signs of anyone being in the vehicle. A week after Dorothy disappeared, her mother Vera got a phone call at home. A man on the other line asked, "Are you related to Dorothy Scott?" And she told him yes. The man responded, "I've got her," and then hung up before Vera could even register what he had said. 2 weeks later, a local newspaper ran a story on Dorothy's case, and only hours after the newspaper hit stands that morning, the editor received a phone call from what is believed to be the same man who called Vera. The man on the phone told the editor, quote, "She was my love. I caught her cheating with another man. She denied having someone else. I killed her." He also shared details with the editor that hadn't been printed in the story. Like, the man knew Dorothy was wearing a red scarf at the hospital, which is a pretty significant detail because technically everybody who saw her that night remembers her wearing the black scarf. The only people who knew that she switched out for the red would have been her two coworkers who were with her, who went to the hospital. This man also knew that Conrad was being treated for a spider bite, but in the article, all they said was that she took her friend to the emergency room for a medical emergency. They did not specify what it was.
So this was someone that was at the hospital then? It seems so.
It seems so. And this man calling the editor, he alleged that Dorothy herself had called him to inform him that she was at that specific hospital. But that's not true because remember that Dorothy's coworker Pam said that they were together the whole night. She said the only time Dorothy wasn't with her was when she used the bathroom and then walked out to the car. But in that time, they were probably only separated for like 10 minutes total before she and Conrad saw the car speeding away. So that just doesn't make any sense. Like, there's no way she could have used the payphone to call a landline somewhere, mm-hmm. and that person would have arrived and
in the 10 minutes.
Yeah, there's just no way. So this newspaper had exclusive coverage on Dorothy's case. So the caller responding to that article and sharing details that hadn't been printed was very telling. No other media outlets had covered her case yet, so the caller was considered legitimate because there's no other way he would have known those things unless he was actually the person who abducted her. Everyone in Dorothy's life said that they were not aware of her dating anyone. She worked from sun up to sundown, and any free time that she had, she spent with her son. So the whole idea that this guy is claiming that they were seeing each other and she was cheating, literally everyone in her life was just like,
it's impossible.
I don't know how that would even be possible. Yeah. So between these two very upsetting phone calls to Vera and the newspaper editor, Dorothy's friends and family pieced together that Dorothy herself had been receiving calls from this man for several months leading up to her disappearance. Dorothy and her son lived with her aunt, and she started receiving phone calls from this person first at her aunt's home. And then after a while, he also started to call her at work. Dorothy said that his voice was familiar, but no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't place it. The man's calls would flip-flop between affectionate and loving to threatening and nasty. The man started to tell her how much he loved her and how often he was following her. And she believed him because he always relayed accurate details about what she had been wearing that day, where she went and when, who she saw and for how long. One time, he called her at home and told her that he had left a present for her on her car. When she reluctantly went outside, she found a single dead red rose on her windshield.
Oof.
So obviously, this was all very unsettling. But Dorothy didn't know what to do. Her loved ones didn't know what to do. So they did nothing. They didn't report this to the police, and it doesn't sound like Dorothy did anything like switch up her routine or anything like that. She did explore the idea of buying a gun, but ultimately decided against it. Her life was her young son, and she wasn't comfortable having a gun around in case he got into it and maybe hurt himself. 2 weeks before her disappearance, Dorothy's stalker made the most terrifying threat to date. He called her at home and told her that he was going to kidnap her, then cut her into bits and pieces before disposing of her in a way that no one would ever be able to find her. After this particular call, she started taking karate lessons as a form of self-defense, and she went to her first class only a few days before her abduction. After that initial phone call to Vera where the man told her he had her daughter, he began calling her almost every Wednesday afternoon. He typically asked if Dorothy was home and then would relay some terrible message about having her daughter or hurting her daughter or claiming that he had already killed her. His calls only ever came in when Vera was home alone. The police put a trace on the Scott's landline, but the caller never stayed on the phone long enough to allow a trace to occur. These harassing calls went on almost weekly for 4 years. Dorothy had disappeared without a trace, and there wasn't a single new development in her case in all that time. And then one day, Dorothy's father, Jacob, happened to be home, and he picked up the man's call. After this, the man stopped calling, and her parents speculated that either he didn't want to talk to Jacob or he misunderstood and he thought that maybe her parents had moved or changed their number and he wasn't getting to them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Vera and Jacob's pain was unimaginable, and watching their grandson grow up without his mommy was unimaginable. And these disgusting, harassing calls made that pain all the more unbearable. So then for the calls to just stop like that, they didn't know what to make of it. And then on August 6th, 1984, 3 months after the man's last phone call, the one that Jacob picked up, construction workers found Dorothy's charred skeletal remains in Anaheim near Santa Ana Canyon Road. She was identified through dental records and pieces of jewelry that she had been wearing, including her wristwatch, which was frozen in time at 12:30 a.m. May 29th, 1980, an hour and a half after Dorothy was last seen. Authorities believe that her remains were only charred due to a brush fire that had blown through the area 2 years before, and as a result, they could not determine a cause of death. After the discovery of Dorothy's remains was made public, the man resumed his harassing calls to her parents. It's not clear how long these calls continued. Dorothy's parents raised her son, Sean, and sadly, they passed away in 1994 and 2002, never knowing who was behind her death. Dorothy's brother, Jim, has said about his sister that, quote, "To me, she exemplified the word give. She just give and give, no matter what it cost her. She spent her last hours giving and being concerned about others. We have all suffered a great loss, but I'm sure Dorothy would want this time to be about giving." He also stated that even though she isn't here anymore, living in the body that she once did, she still lives on. And that is the unsolved story of Dorothy Scott.
These stalker cases, they're everyone's worst nightmare. Have you ever had an experience with a stalker? I feel like I remember you saying something about this like years ago when I first moved in with you.
I sort of did. I lived in this apartment where I was like, I had a really good relationship with a property manager.
Yeah.
And mostly because I'm a Virgo and I complained a lot.
We had a lot of communication.
We were always in constant communication. Nobody was like a really friendly guy. And there were always maintenance workers. It wasn't a very big building. So mm-hmm. like we kind of just knew everybody and everybody knew us. And this maintenance worker who seemed really off was hired on.
Mm-hmm.
And we had like a communal laundry room. And so I would, you know, sometimes like if you forgot your laundry in the wash or the dryer, another tenant might come and move your stuff to like get it out of the way.
I hate the concept of that.
I have a very hard time
with that.
I know, it was awful. But it didn't happen very often because, again, I'm a Virgo, so I'd always get my stuff on time.
Yeah.
But there were a couple of times where I noticed my underwear was missing.
Oh, yeah, that's where I thought this was going to go.
The first time that I noticed that my underwear was missing, it was after he had seen me putting my laundry in the wash.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't think anything of it because he was just kind of walking by. And around the same time, all of the mail in the mail room was getting stolen. And people, there were no cameras in this building, but someone kept opening up packages and taking all these things out. And I was getting all these packages stolen. And it just seemed weird. And it was like all the tenants were complaining to management.
Yeah.
And this one dude, he just kept giving me the creeps, and I never wanted him to come in and do anything in our apartment. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed a pattern of like once or twice a week, someone would try to gently open up my front door. Like the first time I noticed it, I was sitting on the couch and I had a clear view of the front door, which happened to be locked, thank God. And I'm sitting there watching TV by myself and I hear someone enter the hallway. And, you know, there's other tenants who live nearby, so whatever. And then it's like out of a horror movie. I see the handle slowly turning.
Oh no.
But the deadbolt was locked. And so I'm sitting there frozen. I'm completely frozen. Mm-hmm. And then I don't know what to do. So I get up and I go over and I like slyly peek up out of the peephole and no one is there. But I know that it means that whoever was who just tried to open the door is hiding.
Yes, 100%.
Because there was a really loud door that you would have to go through to get out, and I could see it through the peephole, and there was no other way to get out of that hallway.
That's horrifying.
So that happened, and then there were several other times where like I noticed someone tried to jostle the door, or it just seemed like it was very strange. Mm-hmm. And so this guy was just such a creep, and he just really bugged me. And I had kept telling the manager, I think someone has been trying to get into our apartment, and a lot of our mail was getting stolen and a lot of our packages were getting mm-hmm. opened and left like just strewn around in the like mail room. And then there was this one day where I was at home when I shouldn't have been. I was usually at work at like 3 p.m. and I'm sitting there in the living room and someone ran into the hallway up to my front door and like full body slammed the front door and tried to open it. But it was completely locked. So I was like, what the hell is this? And I go to the peephole and whoever was who did it was gone by the time I got to the front door. So I promptly text the manager and I was like, I have been telling you for weeks, I think someone has been trying to get into my apartment. You need to do something about this. This guy, the manager, he's wearing a suit and his office is like two buildings down away from my apartment building. Within like a minute, he is in the hallway knocking on the door, like yelling and identifying himself. And I look through the people and it's him and I open it up. He's in a suit. He is so disheveled and sweating and like, and then he's like, I open it and he's like, oh, hey, everything good with you?
That's a good manager.
And I was like, yeah, did you get my text? And he was like, I just wanted to make sure everything's okay with you.
So I'm here.
everything is good, right? And I was like, yeah, everything's fine. I'm just telling you that I think somebody tried to get in again. And he's like, yeah, no, I just, yeah, totally. No problem. I'm on top of it. He was trying to be so chill about it. I find out later that they confirmed that that creepy maintenance guy was stealing all the packages, stealing multiple women's underwear from the laundry room. And he had been fired like 10 minutes before I sent that text message to the guy. Yeah.
So he was doing it probably to other people as well.
He was definitely doing it to other people. But I think when he got fired, he just seemed so mentally unstable.
Unhinged.
And then I think when he got fired, he was so furious that he just went straight to my apartment building because he still had access. And he went straight to my door and just like tried one last time.
My last shot.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
So I don't know. I guess that's sort of
that's a stalker. That's definitely a stalker situation.
I think so. But that's kind of all I have. Do you have any stalker stories?
The closest one I have was this guy in my freshman year dorm. It was like co-ed. And I would do laundry. And then I would find my laundry like folded in front of my door. And
I
what? And I was like, wait, okay. First of all, this is weird, but I also hate folding laundry. So this is kind of great. Like of all the things that a creepy person could do, it could be worse. And they were done phenomenally, like meticulous folding.
Oh my God.
He did this multiple times. And then it got to the point where like I took a night class, and when I'd get home at like 8:30, he would be standing outside my door waiting for me to get home and be like, you know, you didn't get home. Like, where were you? Or were you with a guy?
Oh my God.
And I was like, whoa, buddy. Like I'd only met him like once or twice.
I thought we were cool with you just like doing the laundry.
There doesn't need to be interaction. I do like the way you fold things. Okay.
Oh my God.
But that was the closest thing, was him just being like weirdly overprotective. And I remember one time having one late night, and I showed up and he was sitting in front of my door, just like sitting with his like hands on his knees like this, like crouched.
Ew.
And that actually terrified me. And he was like, I just wanted to make sure you got home safe. So he kind of disguised his creepiness with like protectiveness.
Yeah, but
which
it's
I
still,
really don't like.
Yeah,
I have a hard time with men that do that.
You just prefer a straightforward creep.
Just be a straightforward creep.
Fair enough.
Yeah, don't disguise it with the gentleman chivalrous stuff. But other than that, just, you know, stalkerish DMs. But
well, yeah,
you know, hey, we all get those.
Yeah, we all get those. But you especially.
Yeah. No one asked for it. Really good job telling that story.
Thanks.
I do like that we're covering a lot of like unsolved cases. I didn't used to like those. Got to cover them all.
Yeah, we got to cover all of them.
Absolutely.
And you just never know who knows something.
That's so then why my not? Thoughts exactly.
Why not just share? Okay, so what do you have today?
So I was inspired by your missing persons case.
From last Wednesday.
And so I decided to cover one too, because I figure it raises awareness, and anything and everything you might know might help.
Yeah.
You never know.
It's what they always say. You never know. The slightest detail that you might think is insignificant might be all that it takes to help someone.
It's also been enough time that I think people feel a little bit more brave or comfortable coming forward, and there's anonymous tip lines and things like that. And I'll provide all of that at the end.
Okay. We can also include all that stuff in the description.
Yeah. On March 19th, 2004, 17-year-old Brianna Maitland took an exam to receive her GED. This was a huge deal for her. Brianna craved independence more than anything. Even though she had a relatively good home life, she decided to move away from her parents' farm at the age of 17. She wanted to be closer to her group of friends, so she crashed at their houses while she attended a high school 15 miles away. She had a hard time juggling schoolwork, and the instability was starting to wear on her. So she dropped out of high school and moved in with one of her childhood friends, Jillian Stout. Brianna wanted to complete her education, so she enrolled in a GED program. Only a month later, she took her exam. To celebrate, her mom, Kelly, took her out to lunch. They were both in a great mood, and the conversation largely revolved around future college plans. After they wrapped up lunch, they shopped around and ran a few errands. When they were waiting in a checkout line at one of the stores, Kelly recalled that Brianna saw something outside that caught her eye. Brianna quickly told her mother that she'd be right back and walked out of the store. Kelly continued to wait in line and made her purchase before meeting Brianna outside in the parking lot. Kelly immediately noticed her daughter was not okay. Brianna seemed shaken up and agitated. Kelly didn't want to pry, so she didn't question when her daughter asked to be dropped off to get ready for work. Kelly dropped Brianna off at Jillian's house around 3:30 or 4 p.m. Before leaving for her shift at Black Lantern Inn, she wrote a note for Jillian saying that she would be home after work. At 11:20 p.m., Brianna clocked out and told her coworkers that she was heading home for the night. The inn was located in Montgomery, Vermont, a small picturesque town with a population of a little over 1,100 people.
Is there a single place in Vermont that is not picturesque?
I Googled it and it was like a screensaver. Everything is like beautiful white little farms and, you know, changing leaves. It's incredible.
I think that's just Vermont.
That's Vermont as a whole. Detective Angela Baker said, quote, "It was an upscale bed and breakfast at the time in a ski town. It wasn't a noisy bar that people were hanging out at. It was an upscale bed and breakfast. She remained in the back of the restaurant for the most part doing the dishes." Brianna drove off in her 1985 Oldsmobile, but she never made it home. In fact, no one has seen or heard from her since. The following day, Brianna's car was found backed into the side of an abandoned house that was only about a mile away from where she worked. Locals referred to the house as the Old Dutch Burnt House. Based off photos, it hadn't been occupied in decades. Brianna's car had run into the side of the house, and because the place is dilapidated, plywood had fallen off and landed on the trunk of the car. On the front seat of the car were two of Brianna's paychecks. Inside there was an ATM card. contact lens case, her glasses, and migraine medication. Outside of the car, loose change, an unused cigarette, and a water bottle was found. Based off the state of the abandoned car, the Vermont State Trooper assumed a drunk driver had left it there. A towing company was called, and it was taken to a local garage. Brianna's friend Jillian had seen the note that Brianna wrote on the 19th, but she was going away for the weekend, and she didn't think twice about not hearing from Brianna. When Jillian returned on Monday, she saw the note was still sitting in the same spot. Once again, Jillian wasn't alarmed. Brianna had a history of moving from house to house, so she figured she was staying elsewhere. However, when Jillian hadn't heard from her the following day, she decided she needed to call Kelly. Kelly also hadn't heard from her daughter since she dropped her off the Friday before. She began to call her friends and her boss, but no one had spoken to her. On Tuesday, March 23rd, Brianna Maitland was reported missing, 5 days after she had last been seen. At this point, Kelly had no idea that her daughter's Oldsmobile had been found abandoned and taken to a lot. 2 days later, on Thursday the 25th, Kelly handed over photos of Brianna to the Vermont State Police. That's when a trooper showed her a photo of the abandoned car that was found at the old Dutch Burn house. When Kelly saw a photo of her daughter's car crashed in the side of the house, she knew that someone else had done this. Her daughter was not the one to leave the car. When news broke of Brianna's disappearance, multiple witnesses came forward to report sightings of the car. Between 11:30 p.m. and 12:30 a.m., a man drove by the old Dutch Burn house and saw her car's headlights on. He didn't see anyone in or near the car. Sometime between 12 and 12:30 a.m., another man drove by the house and saw the turn signal flashing from the car. Around 4 a.m., Brianna's ex-boyfriend said he was leaving a party when he drove by the house and recognized her car. He didn't see her or anyone inside or around the car. Vermont State Police conducted a thorough search of the area surrounding the house, but found nothing. The State Crime Laboratory found nothing suspicious inside the vehicle either. Law enforcement had no answers, but concluded that her disappearance was most likely a result of foul play. The FBI believed the car was staged to appear as an accident. A week after Brianna Maitland disappeared, the Vermont State Police received an anonymous tip about her whereabouts. They claimed that she was being held in a house about 10 miles from Montgomery, against her will. This house was occupied by two known drug dealers, Ramon Ryans and Nathaniel Jackson. The house was raided on April 15th, and while there was a large amount of cocaine and weed, there were no signs of Brianna. Even though police didn't find anything related to Brianna's disappearance, they were still suspicious of the two men. Friends of Brianna's had been interviewed, and they revealed that not only had she experimented with crack cocaine recently, but she was also an acquaintance of Ramon and Nathaniel. That wouldn't be the last tip the law enforcement received about the two drug dealers. In late 2004, an anonymous woman sent in a letter claiming that Ramon and Nathaniel were responsible for not only her disappearance, but her murder as well. In a signed affidavit, the woman claimed that Brianna had been murdered about a week after she went missing. Brianna had purchased crack from Ramon and still owed him money. When an argument broke out, Ramon killed her. Her body was being stored in a basement belonging to a recently incarcerated woman before being dismembered with a saw.
Oh.
Brianna was allegedly disposed on a pig farm. Even though this letter was very specific and written in graphic detail, law enforcement was not able to corroborate the claims. 3 weeks before Brianna went missing, she was brutally attacked by a former friend, Keely LaCrosse. It's unclear what caused the fight, but Brianna's father believed that had to do with Brianna receiving male attention that Keely was jealous about. Regardless of the motive, Brianna was left with a concussion and a broken nose. She even went to the police to press charges against Keely. Investigators questioned her, but there didn't seem to be any connection between the fight and Brianna's disappearance. Fast forward to March of this year, 15 years after Brianna's disappearance. According to CBS News, Vermont State Police investigators use advanced DNA sequencing techniques to identify a sample found as part of their investigation. The samples were added to the FBI database and compared to the 11 people of interest in the case, but a match was not found. In 2020, the state police sent samples to a Texas-based forensic sequencing lab as well as to the Vermont Forensic Laboratory. It was confirmed that DNA from one of the individuals matched the DNA found on the ground near Brianna's vehicle. And while this is hopeful, Investigators say identifying the source of the DNA found near the abandoned car of Breonna Maitland does not mean that they have identified a suspect in her disappearance. Breonna's father, Bruce, made the following statement to Fox News. I don't think this was a random act of being in the wrong place at the wrong time. There was something going on in Breonna's life that we don't know about. She had obviously made a connection with someone that may have resulted in what happened to her. As of today, this is still an open case. If you know any information regards to Breonna Maitland's case, you can leave an anonymous tip at the Vermont State Police website. Detective Angela Baker said, quote, it's not unsolvable. I think that the answer lies somewhere, and I think that we just haven't, you haven't either asked the right question or we haven't asked the right person yet, end quote. And that is the story of Breonna Maitland. I just couldn't help but think when all of the people were driving by and seeing her car.
Yeah.
There had to have been activity that was happening as the people were driving by, because first the lights are flashing on and then the blinker is going on at different parts of the evening.
Yeah.
And then when the ex-boyfriend drove by, he didn't report that any lights were on. He just recognized the car.
Yeah.
So it means that that was a very, very important time.
Yeah.
To which she disappeared. But unfortunately, there's nothing found on the car. These people wiped it completely clean. There's nothing found.
I have 100,000 questions, and I know that you don't have a single answer because this isn't solved, but this is, that's just infuriating. Did you know that like the entire state of Vermont, the population is like 600,000 people?
It's insanely small. It's insanely everyone knows everyone. Small.
Yeah.
So
someone knows something.
Someone does know something, especially when I think it's like a high school girl involved.
Yeah.
You know, people talk and high schoolers really, really talk. And she clearly had gotten caught up in a very tough crowd at a very young age. And just looking at her, she looks like she's like 27 when she's 17.
Oh, yeah.
She's someone that definitely developed early and then also made herself appear very adult-like. And she also craved independence. And her mom said in a quote that they had a really good home life, that there really wasn't issues, but that she was one of those people that really liked the chaos and that she really liked basically skipping from house to house and, you know, and couch surfing and things like that. Yeah. She didn't want the stability.
Yeah.
So with that comes a lot of instability.
Yeah.
That can be very frightening.
Yeah.
And I think it's very, in my opinion, it's very obvious that the drug dealers were responsible because she hung out with these guys. She had recently started smoking crack.
Yeah.
And she owed them money.
The chances of them not being involved would be absolutely wild.
Would be incredibly slim.
Yeah.
And the guys were arrested on drug charges, but you know, it's not enough.
No, obviously not.
It's definitely not enough. And that's my story.
Well, thank you for telling that.
Yeah, no problem. Happy hump day. Love you.
I love you.
Bye.
Bye.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe wherever you enjoy listening. We owe everything to the many journalists, authors, filmmakers, psychiatrists, and psychologists whose extensive work and expertise we pulled from to share this episode with you. To view detailed source material, as well as content from today, please visit us on Instagram and TikTok at Shorties Podcast. We really love doing this show, and if you'd like to help with the continued creation of it, you can support by donating to our Patreon, patreon.com/shortiespodcast. This episode was hosted by Ashley Brumley Johnson and Anika Tharina.